the dying embers of human existence as the asteroid, a behemoth the size of Texas, hurtles relentlessly toward Earth. The world braces for an apocalyptic end. Deep beneath the bunker, a refuge plunges into the bowels of the Earth. Here the Chosen gather, their purpose clear, to preserve the very soul of our civilization. The 35 and 70 millimeter prints that encapsulate the magic, the emotion, and the dreams of generations past. These masterpieces, each frame a testament to the human spirit, are carefully cataloged and cradled in the cavernous confines of the bunker. Perhaps there was room for more. For friends and family yearning for salvation, but sacrifices must be made. The movie nerds stand united, the keepers of a flame, promising a future where the art of storytelling endures, transcending the boundaries of time and space. God help us all.
Welcome to Back to the Framerate, part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. Join us as we watch and discuss films on VOD and streaming platforms, deliberating on whether each one is worthy of salvation or destined for destruction in the face of the impending asteroid apocalypse. I'm Nathan Schuer, and accompanying me are the extraordinary movie mavens Brianna Butterworth, Ellie Escobar, and Sam Cole.
Hello.
I don't have a question for you guys this week. I've been doing that the last few weeks, and I think that's because I'm worn out from this film. But I won't spoil my thoughts quite yet. But the movie that we watched this past week is the 1985 film Out of Africa, and the stars Meryl Streep and Robert Redford, and who else? There's a slew of other people that were I've seen here and there, but I can't. But this is also directed by Sidney Pollack, who is a very well known director, and you know, he actually, you know, he's a pretty fine actor, I think, as well. When I do see him in some movies, so I've always charmed when I see him turn on his acting chops. He was really good in Michael Clayton, I remember that. But anyways, we're going to get into it tonight on the show, but before we do, I have a plot synopsis, and this is the first one. I have two plot synopsi. This is my favorite. this is my favorite one. A film about a white woman named Karen bossing around children of color. That was the first one. But the real plot synopsis is initially set on being a dairy farmer. The aristocratic Karen Blixen, played by Meryl Streep, travels to Africa to join her husband, Broer, played by Klaus Maria Brandauer, who instead spends their money on a coffee plantation. After discovering Broer is unfaithful, Karen develops feelings for Hunter Denise, played by Robert Redford, but realizes he prefers a simplistic lifestyle compared to the upper class background. The two continue on until a series of events force Karen to choose between her love and personal growth. That's, I guess, one way of putting this movie. And I'll just play a quick part of the trailer for this. Actually, I had a really hard time finding the trailer for this online on YouTube. And I don't know if there was an official trailer. This is the official trailer because I did not find something that was really satisfying. But this is what I got.
It's an odd feeling. Farewell. Men go off to be tested for courage. And if we are tested at all, it's for patience. For doing without. And I'd always known that.
Is life really so damn simple for you?
Perhaps I ask less of it than you do.
I don't believe that at all.
Next time you change your mind, you do it with your money.
They bought you a title, Baronessa. They didn't buy me.
All right, I'm ringing the gong on this because whatever scoring they did for this trailer, I don't know, but
a little atonal. That trailer makes Meryl's accent work stand out more than I thought it did in the film. It wasn't that bad to me in the movie. I kind of got used to it, but in the trailer, I was like, "Oh,
that accent work, yeah." So yeah, Sam, how are you tonight?
I'm pretty good. Can't complain. Doing well. Really glad it's March. I like the ascension into spring and summer. I always have. So I just fan of this season in general.
Excellent. Do you have some movie facts you'd like to share with us?
Absolutely. Indeed, I will. So as we know, Out of Africa came out in 1985, December 85. It was directed by Sidney Pollack. And it's based on Out of Africa by Isaac Dinesen, which is actually a pen name for the real Karen Blixen, who was in Kenya from 1913 to 1931. I actually just bought the book off Google, so hopefully it comes soon. I'm like fascinated by it.
I can't. Has anyone else read the book? Any of the sources?
I know, but it sounds awesome.
Yeah.
and her true story is apparently, there's a lot that they left out in the film. But one, before I mention a couple other things, one thing I actually saw the making of this film several years ago, and just an interesting kind of geeky cinematic thing, but Sidney Pollack actually on purpose chose the 1.85:1 aspect ratio, the flat aspect ratio, because he said that because this came out in the mid 80s, he assumed that mostly people would be watching it on their televisions after it came out in the theater. And so he just wanted to have an aspect ratio that gelled with that, which I thought was fascinating because it was kind of a choice. So this stars Robert Redford, Meryl Streep, and if I may say, an excellent performance by Claus Maria Brandauer, or I'm not quite sure. And
nominated.
Yep. The film actually won Best Picture and swept several Oscars, which we'll definitely discuss. Cinematography by David Watkin. It was edited by a lot of people, actually. And of course, the music by John Barry, who also composed Dancing with Wolves. It's a grandiose, epic classical score. This movie was a hit. Yeah.
To go back to David Watkin, I think it needs to mention B. He was the cinematographer for, I think, one of your favorite movies, Moonstruck. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that.
No way. Cool.
Yeah. That gets a half star bump from me. Sorry, guys.
Hey, I knocked off a half a star for the title of Society of the Snow. I was a jerk, even though that movie's awesome.
I forgot about that.
Continue, Sam. Sorry.
And but it was a box office success. It had a budget of $31 million, which in 1985 dollars is actually like only $5 million less than Return of the Jedi, which was 2 years before. So kind of expensive. But box office worldwide gross was $227 million, so it did well.
Yeah,
that's basically if you want to jump in and add anything, but that's just the basic production info.
I want to also add that other films released on the same date were The Color Purple and Enemy Mine, Brazil, and The Trip to Bountiful all came out on this. I think it was December 20th. What the date was? Crazy. And, I think it's also good to note that it opened number four that week. Rocky IV was number one. Jewel of the Nile, a movie that B does not believe exists, was number two. And Spies Like Us was number three. And this is really funny. At number 13 in its 25th week, still in 807 theaters nationwide, Back to the Future, which came out in July that year. Yeah.
Mega hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely a random group. Can you imagine all those movies like hanging out at a pub together, what they talk about? Like, that's a crazy group of films right there.
But I think we just talked about what the cream of the crop of 1985 was. Because before we get into the discussion, I have to say, 1985, not the strongest year for movies.
No, sir.
And you can look at
Rambo
just
the Part 2 was incredible. Rambo First Blood was too incredible. I
made a list here, and I'm gonna go through I'm gonna say this really fast. These were the top movies of 1985, and I just made a list of like 30 of these. So we have Rocky IV. Cocoon came out that year, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, Witness, European Vacation, Commando, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Back to the Future, of course, Color Purple, Ron, the Kurosawa movie, Kiss of the Spider-Woman. We also had movies like Teen Wolf, Explorers, Desperately Seeking Susan, Legend, After Hours, Spies Like Us, Hey, Endless Fire, Brewster's Millions, Perfect, Tough Turf, Vision Quest, Silverado, St. Elmo's Fire, The Falcon and the Snowman, Fletch, one of my personal favorites, Volunteers, The Man with One Red Shoe, Pretty's Honor, Friday the 13th, A New Beginning, The Black Cauldron. This is where we were in the world of Disney. Oh, wow. Porky's Revenge. Porky's Revenge.
Porky's.
These were the top like 30 movies of the year. And I'm telling you, there's not much in here that really like so strikes bad. Me as like a great year. Also, Lady Hawk and Silverado.
You know, it's no 1984, which we talked about before. 1984, a significantly better year. The drop off.
Yeah.
Man. Of that lot, though, I'd say, I don't know if Witness made the list, but Witness came out in 85. That movie is by Peter Weir is like
probably excellent. My favorite movie of 80. Well, maybe not my favorite. It's up there. It might be my favorite of 85. Well, Back to the Future was that year too. You know what's funny? We're about to get into a movie, but since we're kind of talking about like a little bit about the Oscars, this movie got 11 nominations, 7 wins, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Sound, Best got Best Cinematography, Best Score. You know what movie was not even nominated for Best Score?
Was it Amadeus?
Back to the Future. Alan Silvestri's score was not even nominated that year. And think about how iconic Back to the Future was. Yeah. You think about that movie and that score, and that wasn't even nominated. I don't know. I think that's interesting.
Should have been nominated, yeah.
Anyways, all right. Enough of me rambling on about Oscars and stuff. We're not here to do that until maybe later. But all right. So let's get into this. We randomly decided who was going to begin. And B...
I drew the short straw.
You did. Tell us about your thoughts on Out of Africa.
Sure. I got to kick this off. I don't think I have as strong of feelings as some of you, my co-hosts, do about this. I didn't think it was exceptionally good or exceptionally terrible. I got what I was doing. It was a very pretty to look at epic romance. And I wasn't mad about the pacing either. This seems to be the thing that comes up the most is how slow and draggy it is. For me, that just felt a little luxurious. I was like, I get it. We're here. We're in Nairobi. We're in the Serengeti. We're looking at these beautiful landscapes. It kind of reminded me of some Jane Campion stuff. I was just able to slip into it. And that didn't bother me as much. And honestly, I thought the romance was, I thought it focused on... I didn't think they were a good match. I didn't think Robert Redford and Meryl Streep were a very good match, but I don't think that's inherently unbelievable. I think they both did a good job at trying to figure out this sort of romance that they maybe want back home, but couldn't make happen here. If anything, I think Felicity, who is a desperately underexplored character, would have been the better match for Robert Redford. So I think that's something that was potentially interesting that kind of got dropped off for puritanical reasons. But really, this film just struck me as kind of afraid. It wanted to be this big, beautiful romance, but all the places where it could have dug a lot deeper into what it sounds like is in Karen Blixen's book about colonialism, about the relationship to the Kikuyu tribe, about the relationship to the Maasai. That's really sanded down. And I wouldn't call it a white savior narrative, but I do think it's problematic in the way it portrays Native Africans in the film. And you have a little bit of Robert Redford trying to, you know, stand up for the Africans or whatever, but it just struck me as,
does he?
Pretty hollow. Yeah, well, there's that, well we're not going to turn them into little Englishmen, right? But it's really, it's pretty poorly done and sad, and the characters are hollow and they're constantly in service to the white folks in the film. So that was, I would have loved more exploration and toothiness into that aspect of it, especially for a business that fails in the end, right? Like, she's going broke long before the fire. So, you know, I don't love at the end that it's just that sort of, it's so glossed over and the characters are so one-dimensional. I think that's a real disservice to the film, and it could have added a lot more dimension. So it's frankly racist, but I thought it was a pretty to look at, believable romance. And yeah, I get it. I saw this and I was like, yeah, I get it. I can see slipping into this for 2.5-3 hours, popping on the couch, watching it. I got it. Yeah.
Do you have?
It was gorgeous to look at, which I know you have feelings about, Nathan, but I really enjoyed looking at it.
No, I'm not necessarily disagreeing, but We'll get to my thoughts in a moment. Sure. So do you have a rating you have for this?
Yeah, I'd give it a 3.
Okay. So I'm a little conflicted with this film. You know, full disclosure, I watched this movie twice over the past 2 weeks to try to fully immerse myself in everything. The first time I watched this when I watch a movie, I've done this a few times for the podcast. I watch it the first time, take a whole bunch of notes and do it for the review. And if I have a hard time finding my entry point into the story, you know, I'll watch it again. But this time I watched it a second time. And what I will say about the first time is I had a hard time really getting into it. I watched it a second time. I just put the notebook aside and I let this movie kind of wash over me. Mm-hmm. And I got so much more out of it where I wasn't trying to like review it. And it is a movie I think needs to, you benefit from that type of thing. And it's rare I get to do that. But we had a couple of weeks to watch this. So I took my time to really.
Is 10 hours long. So you do need.
What I wouldn't say is it didn't really change my opinion so drastically that I went from hating this to loving it. But I think it does kind of emphasize the notion that, you know, there's so many movies out there that it can almost feel like watching movies can be a disposable activity. We so often like watch a film and then it's like on to the next thing. But I really appreciate it when I can watch something and not fully get something out of it, but then go back and watch it again and really understand now what's happening in it. So I'm happy that I got to do that. So anyways, this movie though, Out of Africa is one of those perfectly serviceable 80s stately costume dramas. I found the story of Karen to actually be, you know, her story to be quite interesting as far as in most enigmatic part of the film, you know, not necessarily the romance in this. What this woman went through between her husband's transgressions, obstacles, managing her plantation, contracting, you know, this syphilis, which we'll get to be the real drama of this woman's life. Her romance with Robert Redford, his character, I felt was very underwhelming. Part of that was, I think, the plotting of the story, but I also lay that on the feet of the casting of Robert Redford in his overall performance. I do like Robert Redford as an actor, but Robert Redford can't not be Robert Redford. He does his thing. He stays in his lane and he's great in certain things. And sometimes he's just not the right choice to be in a movie. And I think this is an example. He looks amazing in this. I want his wardrobe when I go to Africa. And I think the costuming is fantastic. He looks good. The guy just is glowing in this movie. But at the same time, he just seems so miscast in this. That character's supposed to be an Englishman, and he's the one character. And I think I don't know if it's actually referenced. I don't know if anyone else can attest to this. Is he in this movie supposed to be English? Because I know the character is.
The character was, and all I know is that Sidney Pollack, when Robert Redford was practicing an English accent, Sidney Pollack told him to drop it. Because I think what he was interested, I think he felt the movie needed like an American, like box office kind of, you know, so I don't know. I don't know anything beyond that.
I think I read that there was originally Robert Redford doing his lines with an English accent, and there was a lot of overdubs in post with him going back to, so that would make sense. Thank God Robert Redford is not putting on an English accent, because I can't picture that.
Wouldn't it have been hilarious, though, if it was like a Mary Poppins? They're like, I want to take you on safari, all right? I do.
I thought he was great. Well, we'll talk about it, but I liked him in this role. I thought everyone was great. I thought it was well cast.
He's always good, but I just don't know if this is... I don't know. The other thing I'll say is that, you know, I think we already mentioned this. I have never read the source material, especially the book written by, is it Isaac Dennison? Or I don't know how you pronounce it. It's a pen name for Karen Blixen. Yeah. Anyways, but from what I understand, the the book focuses a lot more on the Kikuyu people, and especially her relationship with Farah, who is her aide, who plays an important role in the story. The movie has zero interest in telling that part of the story, which I think is a shame. And I'm sure we'll get more into that in the discussion. But technically, this film has all the goods: awesome cinematography, outstanding just look and feels of this whole thing. Outside of a couple glaring blue screen shots or rear projection, I don't know what they're doing. I was like, what? Like, I could do that, but
one of those opening shots where they're like clearly.
I don't understand. They're
like matted in, and they're sitting in Denmark, and that was a terrible one. Also, when she's in her like room writing, and it pans out the window, and the window is like a green screen, like that
there's
terrible.
A few guffaw moments where I was like, I don't. Yeah. They make a movie look this good, but yet there's a few head scratching effects that I just don't understand. And of course, we have to mention John Barry's score is incredible. We already said beforehand that, you know, I don't understand why Alan Silvestri wasn't nominated for Back to the Future, but I can't complain that this movie won best score as well. Cause I think John Barry is one of our best ever composers. And he was incredible. He did a lot of the James Bond scores. Oh, man, Dances with Wolves he did as well. So he's one of my favorites. So I have no complaints about that. Anyways, I agree with B. I also gave this movie a 3. So I'm in lockstep with you on that. Let's go to, we're going to Sam.
So I've actually watched this movie several times over the years, and regardless of like the plot or the story or the setting, there's this kind of romantic, like longing, like undertone to the movie that gets me every single time, that I'm a complete sucker for. I mean, as soon as she's like, I had the farm in Africa, and it like cuts to me, a train like going through the plains, and John Barry's music like swells, like I'm practically like already in tears. Like I'm just like, yep, this is incredible. I don't, there's a traveler in me that appeals to that romantic spirit.
I get it.
Before I briefly get into my like review, I genuinely understand people's criticisms of this movie. Like I can understand people talking about like the slow pace or not liking it. Interestingly for me, I love this movie, but I don't feel defensive about it. Like if someone hated E.T. the Extraterrestrial, that would hurt my soul. I'd be like, you have no heart. Like what's your problem? This movie touches me personally, and I love it, but I really understand the criticisms. I think for me, it's the tonality. I also am just fascinated, like that. I like movies that kind of like are a period pieces or look into time periods. And so this is basically like British colonialism in Kenya from like 1913 to 31. I do agree though that the movie is very interested in like the British characters and colonials, completely ignores the Kikuyu, even though they're featured in it. And I totally understand those kind of racist underpinnings. I'd say, I don't think the movie intentionally does that, but it's for an 80s film. It's very focused on like, it's about the British characters, good or ill. But I also I like that movies that like, this is a longer film. It's actually 2 hours and 37 minutes without credits. And I looked at that because I'm like a nutcase when it comes to numbers. I just love memorizing it. Like Boogie Nights is 2 minutes.
Wait till we get to The English Patient.
Yeah. but I like it. I'm always interested in editing and pacing and structure, how a film tells a story like over an 18-year time span. And what you were saying about how you like, you roll with the vibe of this movie, like you get there and she shows up. This movie has different seasons in it. And so when I watch this movie, I feel like I'm taking this kind of journey and I'm like along on the ride of her life. I really love it when Robert Redford and Barclay Cole, I forget the actor's name, but
Michael Kitchen.
Yeah, when they show up at her house and it's just like storytelling and like dinner time, I find that whole scene charming. I feel like I'm sitting there, like I just love these people right now in this moment.
Side note, sorry to interrupt you, Sam. Do you think she has better chemistry with Barclay than she does with Robert Redford?
It's more natural chemistry with Barclay. The chemistry with Robert Redford is a little bit forced at time. It gets better. I understand where Nathan was coming from. Personally, I thought Redford was great in the role, and I have kind of too much of an attachment to the movie. So, but like his point, like I can totally see that. I just thought he fit in well, even if he really seems like unbelievably American.
Swashbuckling.
Yeah. But, and I want to give a shout out to Claus Maria Brandura, because he plays a character who is a guy that if it was played by another actor, you could easily despise this person. He doesn't follow through. He's like, I'm going to go hunt, do whatever I want, whatever. I'm changing from dairy farm. We're going to sell coffee. But the way he plays the character, he knows who he is and she knows who he is. And so like, I just find his performance fat. Like, I think he's a really good actor. And I think that was really interesting casting. Cause like with a lesser screenplay, that guy could have just been like the douchebag, like, you know, character that only exists because he's there to like be in the way. And I just thought he made it like an interesting human being out of him. Yeah. I mean, I love the movie. I feel swept away. And I will say that, you know, since we were watching it to review it, I was trying to look in more detail. And my God, these people, these British colonists in this time period, my God, do those people drink. Like every single scene, they've got a drink in hand. Even the doctor, when he tells Meryl Streep she has syphilis, he's like pouring himself a scotch and he's like, you've got syphilis. I'm like, man, he's like, what is it? Like noon? What's going on here? You know? But it just,
they cure it with arsenic? Is that what they do?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. I just kind of fascinating window into those characters, and I love the scenes with the lions, and of course John Barry's score. Like it's some moments are a little bit uneven, but overall, for me, the movie is an experience that there's a specificity to it. It's like this movie is like a fine wine, and whenever I return to it, I like going back to that, the world of the film. So not perfect, but I mean, I loved it. But again, I really understand the criticisms. And for me, I would have to say I would give it 4.5 stars.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent. All right. I like your take, Sam. Good.
Well, I, to be honest, I didn't like anything about this movie. Not one thing. I don't like the music. I didn't care for the story.
You didn't even like the music.
No, it's just, I did not like the music. When you come from the Notebook music to this music, you're like, no, it doesn't ring nicely in my ears. So yeah, let me see what else. The wardrobe, it's like typical of the era. Great, all white and khaki and whatever. It's no color. It's very plain browns into that. Anyway, and like the Notebook, you know, it's got the blues. Oh, very lovely. Anyway, there's this scene in the movie where there's like, instead of the boat and the water and the lake and the and you know the what were the geese, it was like flamingos and the plane. All right. Okay, I get it.
Are we reviewing Out of Africa or The Notebook today?
I'm just saying, like, coming from The Notebook to watching Out of Africa, it just didn't do it for me. First of all, the romance
is... I respect this take.
Yeah. The romance is weak. It didn't pull me in. It's not believable, that romance between Meryl Streep. First of all, the romance between her first husband and her is not believable. The romance between Redford and her, it's not believable.
I'm not going to argue with that, no.
It's not. Her accent is horrible. Like, whoever thought that, oh my God, it was annoying to hear Meryl Streep trying to make an accent. Who is it, English?
Danish.
Danish.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Forget
Which
it.
Which is like, why it's terrible as an English accent.
That's yeah. like me trying to make an English accent. It's not going to happen. So, no, that didn't work.
I want to take you on safari. Sorry.
No, it didn't work. Okay, so it dragged. I was like, it dragged as much as Always did for me. Okay, and you know, I'm not a fan of Always. So it's like, oh, when is this movie going to be over? That's my thought. When I cannot wait for the movie to end, and I wish I can just fast forward it to the end and see the end. So you definitely know that movie, it isn't doing anything for me, except for the animals.
There's some good lions.
They were real, right? They're not CGI at that time, right? So yeah, I'm assuming they're real animals. They're like the favorite part of the movie for me. The tiny little animals, and I hope no animal was hurt in the process of making this film, especially the little cows.
Like the hippos, the big hippos, and the.
I love every single animal. I think it was the buffaloes when they got stuck in the and the car got stuck, and she has to like.
Oh, the yak, yeah.
Yeah, they're so cute the way they look at her. I love the animals. I love the little. The students in the classroom, all those little children, they're so adorable. And they think, I wish they gave me more of that than romance that was not there, because that killed it for me. Unfortunately, there were some scenes that were worth watching, like cinematography wise. Yeah, there were some really nice scenes. But overall, for me, this movie, I did not have a connection with it. I'm not sure that I want to read the book, because I probably fall asleep reading the book. I don't know. It just didn't do anything for me. So if I had to rate this movie, I'll rate it just to be nice. I'll give it a 1 star, but that's it. Because I would probably I'll probably give it a 0, but I'll give it a 1 star just because to be nice about it.
Just the courtesy bump.
I mean, I love Refer. Refer is one of my favorite actors. He's handsome as hell. But this... Yeah, this movie, and I'm not a fan of Meryl Streep. I don't know. I'm not a Meryl Streep fan. Everybody, probably the whole world, loves Meryl Streep. I'm okay with her acting. So a 1 star. Didn't care for the movie. There is no romance in this movie. I'm sorry. If this is a romantic movie, it failed to show me the romance.
Well, I'm not going to actually disagree with you. I don't want to jump on you, Sam, but I think the romance in this is definitely secondary to the plot.
I agree. Romance is not the best, but I kind of like that the romance is more towards the back end of the movie. Like, you have all this introductory, like, they don't go on safari like almost 2 hours in. You know what I mean? And so it's like a later chapter. You know what it is? I honestly think. The reason why I feel a strong connection to that, I'm a sucker for British, like, stiff upper lip characters. I just always find them fascinating. And like, I don't like condone.
You know, other than Refer and Stripped, I didn't know any other actor in that movie. The only two people I know is Refer and Stripped. I don't know the other actors. Well,
did you catch the cameo? Did you catch the cameo? Who was Michael Kitchen, the guy who plays Barkley? His mistress was Iman, the model Iman.
And Bowie's wife.
Lord Delamere Alfred.
Always a guy. I'm a sucker for these, like, this early century exploration movies.
And in a way, this film kind of made me angry, honestly. Like, if it was supposed to make me feel different, it kind of made me angry. I'll tell you why it made me angry. Because, first of all, she ends up with syphilis, right? And then I can think of, like, it is the colonizers that brought syphilis to the Native Americans, okay? Simple as that. They didn't have that, but it's the colonizers that had it, okay? Because they, like, went sleeping around with women and different women. And probably, you know, and it kind of made me angry because how they treated the African-American, the African people. And so in a way, I'm watching this film and I'm kind of getting disgusted with it because it brings back these feelings of like, man, like why? Why would you have to treat these people like this is their land? Like, you're coming... Like, whether it's Africa or it was America, you came to invade their lands. And it's like, yeah. So
this movie is wildly flip about colonialism.
Yeah.
Just so like
I was kind of getting angry at one point with the movie. I was like,
it kind of doesn't touch it. It just sort of goes for like, you know what it does? It like, it shows it, but it makes no comment on it. It just presents what they're doing. And it's like, hey, there it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it does comment.
My favorite line in the whole entire film is when that tribe, the chief, comes to her house and says, she wants to make them read and learn English and blah, blah, blah. And he says something to the effect like, oh, yeah, well, your people, the British, know how to read. What good did that do to them? Right? Remember that line at the end? Like, that didn't do them any good, did it? Like, I was like, yes. You tell it, man. I was like, no, but that's like one line that I really loved in the movie. And I was like, yeah.
Wait, question B, when you said the that it does comment on it, would you say the movie is sort of like pro-colonialism or like?
Well, I think it glosses over some things that are harmful and position them in a helpful white savory kind of light on behalf of Meryl Streep's character. Like the school or giving back, you know, she's like, well, we must have land for them and advocating for them. And it's like, well, okay, but you did like force them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, that's not the help that you're portraying it as.
But it's not really that interested in getting into the weeds on it.
It sounds like the real person was. And like this Felicity character was also based on a real person, and she seems incredible too. So there's this like actual history of potentially interesting and incredible woman. I have no idea what their actual history is with the local people, but that's just kind of ignored. But on the romance side, part of me was like, I kind of get it because they're in this totally foreign land. Like, yeah, they're not a good match, but they might be like the only people there. Like, we see Meryl Streep as one of the only women seeking a person there. And I don't know. I did get it. I think they were both kind of fantasies of what the other one wanted, even if it wasn't the right fit.
I thought their romance, and I totally agree with some of that. I thought their romance worked best at the New Year's Eve party when it was New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
It was a good scene. Like, Redford was by himself and he was like clearly really drunk and he missed her. And then there was that scuffle and that, like, I've always liked that scene, that segment. I just was chuckling to myself when she goes back to Denmark. It's just like voiceover and shots of her farm. Because I'm like, well, this is so expensive to shoot this movie in Africa. Like, they're not going to go do another Denmark scene.
Back to Denmark.
And aside the accent, what was with her voice? Why did you have to make her voice like this? Because she sounded like she was so deep talking.
I think it was just all part of her performance. By the way, she talked like this. She listened to tapes from the real Karen Blixen to get that accent, to get that voice right. I'm not supporting the performance, the accent. I watched it the first time and I was like, I am really having a hard time with this accent, with this performance. The second viewing was like, it didn't bother me at all. I just, like I said, it washed over me, but I totally get it. She may have had the greatest dialect coach in the world. It didn't matter to me. I still think that it's laid on thick and I don't know if it really works. I don't think of Meryl Streep as somebody that puts on thick accents in films. And I think it's also because we know what Meryl Streep sounds like.
We know what she sounds like.
We've had her 40 plus years in movies. We know her voice. And I think that's a part of it too.
That's part of it too. It's funny. I actually like, I don't mind her accent. I like it. But one thing that Ellie was mentioning that, and I'm sure this line annoyed you, Ellie, was when she does do that low voice when she's standing out in the rain and Claus is coming back. She's like, come home.
Yeah.
I want to come home.
Or like when she's narrating the whole thing. And oh my God, you know, it drags away. When he's like, oh, tell us a story. I'm thinking, okay, she's going to tell a story of a book that she read. She goes, oh, well, you know, whenever I read a story to my nieces, whatever, they always give me the first line. And I'm like, dude, do not tell me stories, please. Because it's like, it gives them the first line and it's like, and she starts telling the story from that one sentence and it drags that moment. I really don't want to hear your stories, lady. Like, can you just keep it to yourself? Let's keep it to the point of the story. Okay. I don't care.
I loved that stuff. I was like, oh yeah, spin a yarn for me, Meryl Streep. I'm here on a patio with my gin flip. Like, I was so here for it.
Like, I'm definitely towards the pot. Like, I liked Meryl Streep.
And by the way, that plate of food was disgusting.
Moments where her voice is like, there are a couple funny lines, but like, I love it when she's
funny lines in the movie.
No, well, I mean,
it was like a comedy, Ellie. Come on.
Moments where she, where her accent sounds a little, when she's like, come home, it just sounds humorous. But for the most part, it didn't bother me. Like, I liked it, but I understand your point is what I'm saying.
Okay, and what was that dinner plate that was supposed to be chicken and it was fish? And
she was a child, Ellie, taking him for child, like, be nice.
And it was like, no, but the food is so like, it's like, if I was eating my dinner and I saw that plate, I would have been like, oh, that's disgusting.
I was not even focused on the food because I was like, oh my God, they brought much shit with them to
listen,
Africa.
The movie was so boring to me that I actually started not listening, but watching in detail all the items in the film. Like the watch that Refer was wearing, or what about the oranges for every scene when they were going in their safari at dinner time? There's always oranges on the table. Like, what's the point of that?
Did you start counting how many hats, different hats that Meryl Streep wore?
Oh, they were good though. They were some good hats.
I'm a hat person, so I really like the hats. I have to give the hats up.
Yeah, the hat budget for this movie has got to be up there in like one of the highest budgets of any film ever.
I don't think anything in cinema though can ever top Kurt Russell's hat in The Thing.
I don't know this movie. You see her hat at the wedding. That was there was actually a great comment on it, right? Like, does it keep the mosquitoes out or something like that? It was a funny.
Oh, yeah, maybe the big ones.
Maybe the big ones. She said, like, okay.
I liked it.
There's one scene that I found strange where, like, that it's just over the top in a good way where, like, Claus comes up to her and, like, he dramatically, like, grabs her by the face and is like, be careful. And then he kisses her. Then she kisses her back. And it was just, like, dramatic. Yeah.
And very, like, sudden passion for a couple who had been like, listen, this is marriage of convenience.
There was no drama in this film. And honestly, the scenes that were supposed to be scary, like when they were faced with the lions or whatever, they were not scary at all. Like, were you supposed to make
those lions were shipped in from California? That's why. Also,
I thought it was. It wasn't scary, but I thought it was decently effective. Mm-hmm. But I'd also seen the movie many times, so like the first time I saw it, the lion scenes. Now I like know it more like shot by shot, so I'm less emotionally connected. But it's still decent.
It's hard for me to watch actors that are American, English, and do a different accent. There's another actress, I forgot.
Oh, I actually want to get to that.
Jessica Chastain. She's the Zookeeper's Wife movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys watched that. She does an accent in that movie too. And the movie's great. I loved it. But I struggled getting through her accent. It doesn't work for me.
And like I said before, earlier, you know, Robert Redford, I do think was maybe not as much as I do like Robert Redford. I don't know if he was the right choice for this. This is 1985. Who else do you think they could have? I'd like to ask the other hosts here what they think. I actually have a couple names I wrote down here as potential alternate casting. And if you had to pick, like, would it be an Englishman or would it be another American that could maybe do a better accent? Do you have any thoughts on this? Who might be better, Denise? I have a few ideas.
Someone who immediately comes to mind is Burt Reynolds.
Really?
No.
I was going to go with the Back to the Future scientist there.
Christopher Lloyd?
Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Wow. I would not have gone there.
Be very, very different. Yeah.
In a romantic relationship with Meryl Streep?
Yeah. Yeah, I probably would have loved him a lot more than.
It'd be funny, though, if he's in a romantic relationship with Meryl Streep, but as Doc Brown. Like, he's the same. He's like, lions! Lions!
That would have been sick. Maybe that would have been a better film.
28 gigawatts!
That would have been a better film, Sam.
Be like, great Scott, what is it? World War One has started.
B, do you have any other alternate casting for the Robert Redford character? I'm curious.
I'm kind of looking because I've never really thought of actors by year like this. And I'm wondering, Sam Shepard?
Well, I think it's the whole like Days of Heaven thing.
Yeah. I kind of like that he's American because I think the cowboyish optimism that he has in this film is uniquely American and very not British. Whereas Barclay's character, I think of as much more of that stiff upper lip Englishman. So I think Sam Shepard would have been fun.
That's I love Barclay because of his stiff, like that actually just portrays him so, especially when he's
so dryly,
dryly, like when Meryl Streep comes out in search of her husband, he's like, what are you doing out here in the field? He's like, right, I tried.
I think, I'm trying to think. So Robert Redford, he's 87 now. So he was 40. So he was like 48.
Yeah. Meryl Streep was 36.
So the only person I was actually really thinking about this, who it would be, and only names, he'd be a little bit younger than Meryl Streep, but I think Mel Gibson would have been okay in this role.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And he probably would have nailed this, playing that swashbuckling type of character. Totally. Mm-hmm. Might have added a little more humor to it too. Jeremy Irons. I would have had Jeremy Irons in this back in the mid 80s. Yeah. I think it'd been really good. And then we have a Brit in this. And Sam, you'll appreciate this. Roger Moore. Yes.
No.
Like, shoot the lion. No, let's let her get a little bit closer. Roger Moore.
Why not? He's in his mid 50s. You know, he's kind of this is the same year as Video to Kill. He probably wasn't available. They probably asked him.
He'd be great at that scene when he's walking by the train at the very beginning, like carrying Irish. He's like, shoot, get them off the train. It's my Limoges. And he'd be like,
oh, that was so gross. Yeah.
What if they really wanted an Englishman? Maybe they should have put Daniel Day-Lewis there.
Oh, he would have been really young.
How old would he
been in his 20s.
Yeah, but see, that would have been things. That would have been a much juicier romance if they had a younger man and an older woman.
I would have been okay with anything that would have spiced up that romance. I would have been okay with, because I like you, Ellie. I'm not as down on it as much as you are, but I really did not feel the passion between them as much. I think Meryl Streep is actually doing very good work in this. I think Robert Redford is, I'm just showing up. I'm going to play Robert Redford like I do in all my movies. And he's just doing his thing.
But don't we like that?
That's the thing. I do like that. I just felt like he just walked off of, you know, a wardrobe and like, here, put you in this whole thing. You're going to look great. You're ready to go. And I just didn't really buy it. I don't know.
Maybe they should have put Harrison Ford there.
He could have done it. He was, I mean, he's really good in Witness. It would have been a different energy, but
not that different in a lot of ways. But
non sequitur, speaking of British and American, I'm just glad that they never casted an American actor as James Bond.
Maybe Clint Eastwood too.
Oof. We'll get there later.
Clint Eastwood would have an epic stare down with one of the lions. He'd just be like,
I'm sticking with Sammy. I'm sticking with Sam Shepard.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah, he could have.
Who is Sam Shepard? I have to Google it. I don't know Sam Shepard.
Ted Danson.
Ellie, yeah. Sam Shepard from the movie last week or a couple weeks ago.
Man. The dad?
Yeah.
Oh, Noah's dad. No, he's too sweet.
Okay. You should. There's. I don't know.
He's too sweet.
He's too sweet for this epic romance with Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep.
Look at that. Not a romance person.
So I think that's just because that's the movie you're seeing him in. He's got some good stuff. Can we go a little bit through the plot? Because Meryl Streep's kind of thrust into this society that is like trying to recreate her society back home. Mm-hmm. It's English. It's not Danish, but she gets it. It's upper crust aristocracy. And then I don't know. I thought it was really good writing that she sort of behaves around them the way she behaves when she's like out in the wild almost and sees those lions and sees other threats. Like, she's very much a person who tries to isolate herself from any sort of danger. And I was sort of wondering if that's why she's attracted to the people she's attracted to in the film. But I thought there was an interesting through line there.
I could see that. Yeah. I mean, almost sort of adds more sense to her, you know, gravitating towards Robert Redford in a sense.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting. Like, I wondered about how it went over in the, because here's the movie does this thing where it, like, picks up pieces of culture around what's happening, you know, about them, and then drops it. So, like, here's this woman who's a newlywed having two guys at her house overnight drinking, having dinner, and it's the best scene in the movie, I think. And then, like, there's no mention of how that's reflected, what that does to her standing in society, what that means. Like, that just gets kind of dropped off.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, it's kind of interesting because this is, I think it just reinforces her as, like, showing how her, I don't know, is there an undercurrent of feminism that isn't really explicitly stated in this?
I think
is really strong. This might be the most feminist movie we've watched on the show, on the whole podcast, actually.
Yeah.
I think easily.
I did definitely get that. I just wish it wasn't such a white feminist movie, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Her, when the two of them show up, I always just assume that it was like a, maybe a product of the time when, like, guests show up at the house, like them all having dinner together and telling stories seemed like, the way they treated it, the way they were acting, it was like it was a normal, totally normal thing to do. You know what I mean?
Where
they're like, hey, you don't have much say in the matter. She's like, oh, all right. Like, I just remember Sidney Pollack making a big deal when he was in the making of, when he was talking about, in that time period, people entertained each other by telling stories to each other at night, like televisions or necessarily radios. So that was like that scene, I think, was his idea of a window into, like,
a social. Oh, that's probably why they drank a lot too, because there was nothing else to do but to drink. Sure.
I did think that scene was beautiful. I thought that was probably my MVP of the movie. And I also liked when they played Mozart for the monkeys. They were like, never a man-made sound, and then Mozart. That was cute.
Seriously, even when Redford is asleep and, like, by the, and she comes up,
the glass.
Glass is in his hand. Everyone, watch that movie again. Everyone is drinking something at every point of that film, almost. Mm-hmm. Aside from when they're, like, horses, but it's just like those details there. Are, like, I noticed that especially this time because it was just like it seemed very apparent. Mm-hmm.
In their crystal glasses. Their Limoges crystal. Fancy schmancy.
How about, what do you think of this big flying sequence, which I think is kind of a big anchor of this movie?
I just loved it. Again, did not have to work hard for me to love it, because it was like Africa, beautiful, like John Barry going nuts. Like, he's just like grandiose. That was just epicness. You know what? I rewound that scene twice when I was watching it. I loved it so much. I'm like, I gotta see the plane. I gotta see the plane fly one more time. One more time, Lois. Okay, I gotta see the plane.
I didn't rewind it, Sam. I fast forwarded it.
I loved it. They did, at one point they did Mount Kenya, and another point they did that sweeping shot of Kilimanjaro. I was like, oh my God, I'm so hooked. But I think in real life, Felicity was a pilot. She was like a Kenyan aviator. And so
I do think
Felicity the main character.
Go ahead, Sam.
Oh, sorry. She's a friend that comes over and to, like, Meryl Streep's house, and no one's there. And she's like, I want men to like me, but am I supposed to be taken? But I want to be left alone. And then she's like, you can call me Karen.
Yeah. Part of me was like, that's super queer coded. Part of me was like, this is the queerest part of the film for me.
I'm like, is she? But I didn't. But the movie never really. Then she comes back.
It doesn't explore anything else.
It drops a lot of threads.
Drops it when he comes back in 1919 after syphilis. Felicity is, like, married and like, hey, life is grand.
Yeah.
You know, this speaks to something. You know, you mentioned it earlier. This takes place over an 18-year span. And, you know, that still was not clear to me necessarily. I think that the plotting of this movie and might have something to do with the editing of this. It is one of the detriments to this, because I don't think this is kind of like shown, like, in a series of vignettes in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I had no sense of how much time is going by, because she goes, when she does get syphilis, she goes back to Denmark. Sometimes Denise goes flying off, sometimes for like a year or two. I have no idea how long people are gone for.
But didn't you notice that she got a haircut? That should tell you something.
After 18 years, nobody ages, especially like the children from the Kikuyu tribe. They're like, except for somebody has like kind of like a little mustache. He looks exactly like he's still 10 years old, you know?
I totally hear that. I found it like the way time moves a bit dreamlike. I will say that first part, like 1913 up to New Year's 1919, that seemed to move pretty normally to me. And like, they marked the passage of time. Like first she's going through Nairobi on a horse, and then like the automobile gets introduced. That's a cool shot. But I feel like once she is on safari with Robert Redford, the whole third act of that movie feels almost like it could have been one long weekend. And I'm wondering if that was supposed to be like 10 years of time. I will say the passage of time I noticed the most is Barclay Cole when he died, and he looks worse over the years. That I you really feel his arc, and you feel like the age of him. And finally mentioning
his death hit me.
Actor Michael Kitchen played Barclay Cole. I thought he did an amazing job. He seemed to age properly. Yeah,
his death really hit me. You know what would have been a good marker for time? That again, I don't think they explored this too much. And actually, I'm kind of grateful for this, because I think a lot of other movies would have dove a lot deeper into this and I would have been bored to tears. The war, the militias, that sort of like, that's quick. That's sequence.
Did it happen? I don't remember.
So like,
called to town because World War One and like the East German push or what it's called. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So they're like responding to the militia's need for supplies and stuff, and all the men are going off. And I just think other movies would have really honed in on that as like a bigger deal and use that as a driver for more character development. And this is really just talking about the sort of fraying that's happening in the relationship with Klaus and Karen. But it was like quick. It happened fast.
Yeah, World War One comes in on the edges of the fringes and like bleeds in a little bit, and then the story goes on. And interestingly enough, I didn't mind that. I mean, I was fine with it. Yeah, like they could have gone into the one mentioned when she was going to meet her husband to like give him supplies, and they encounter that tribe that is like sort of threatening to them, you know, and like the tribe is like with their spears, they're like coming across
the Maasai.
Weren't the Maasai like being used by German soldiers or something? I thought that might have been a World War One reference, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. But
this movie lost me in so many ways, and it's not even funny. I mean, they went from one place to another. I don't know what the tribe walking in the middle of her going to drop off the supplies was the whole point of it. What's the point of it? It just doesn't make sense. You just plug in things and people to fill in stuff in your movie, and you try to give me an 18-year span of a movie in a 2.5-hour movie. Yeah, that's not gonna go very well, Pollock.
It's okay. We have a different movie next week. I think you like it.
Which one is it?
Atonement.
I know I'm gonna like it. I like that movie.
It's interesting, because I like it when movies attempt to handle the passage of time, like totally different movie. But I feel like Boogie Nights goes from 1970, and you are aware of everything. And this, like, it's just different, like, you know.
Boogie Nights. Well, Atonement does it too, and we'll talk about it next week. Oh, that's another one.
Let's talk about how this, before we wrap this up, let's talk about the ending of this movie.
Movies have those time, like when movies attempt, I'm always fascinated by how much time they devote to what. That's why Out of Africa is interesting, because it's like the first two acts feel like real time, and to me the third act feels like this dream, like, and you're like, where are we?
Well, it's like the piano for me. I brought up Jane Campion earlier. This sort of feels a little bit like the piano for me.
I hear that.
I get that. Yeah, let's just quickly talk about how this movie wraps up and the ending of this, which I feel, for me, It's a little meh for me. As we know, the Robert Redford character, Denise, he dies in the end in a plane crash that happens off camera. This happens in real life. This character does die. And I was kind of like, because what I don't like the way this is portrayed is that it's never really foreshadowed. And it just kind of comes out of nowhere. And it's presented. I know that Streep's character is told about it by her ex-husband. I don't know if they actually stayed married or not. I don't know. And it just seems like such like a just like the whole thing just kind of drops flat for me. And I really thought that this was a dull way of ending the film, especially when it's supposed to be this sweeping romance and it just kind of like ends. I don't know what you guys think of this. I did not like this.
I hear that. I
mean, although it didn't make it easier for her to go because she was heading out. She was leaving anyways.
It didn't bother me much because for me, it felt more like the sort of the shock of like a shocking death in real life. Like that if all of a sudden you're like this terrible example, but like you're scrolling on Facebook and all of a sudden you learn that someone you knew died. Bad example because like they were in a romance. So, but I agree, it is sort of perfunctory. But like
that's happened this week to me. So go ahead. Yeah.
Oh man. but like even though it feels a little perfunctory, I didn't mind it. I hear what you're saying. For me, it felt like a coda to her whole like experience there. Like you know, things were too good to be true. Mm. And I did like the funeral scene when like the lions show up on the hillside. I find the ending kind
of
love
that.
It's like her whole experience is coming to an end. So like your window into the world of that movie that you've been with for 2.5 hours, it's like a quiet goodbye to it. So I find it kind of like wistful, but in an effective mm-hmm. way. But again, I hear your point. What's interesting about this movie is like, I see everyone's point. It's, and even mm-hmm. though I like the movies a lot, it's, I genuinely get what you're saying. Like I can definitely yeah. see that.
It just felt like it was like a waste.
As soon as I saw the plane show up in a scene, I knew they were going to kill Redford in a plane crash. I just knew it. It's like so obvious. For me, that was so obvious. It's like, okay, he shows up in the plane. They go flying together, blah, blah, blah. And I'm in my head thinking like, he's going to die in an airplane crash. I just know it. And then it goes the end of the romance.
One thing it does is like we talk about time, like you mentioned that like you knew that was going to happen. Maybe the plane was foreshadowing that sort of early on, but at the very beginning of the movie, when she just jumps around in the time of the narrative, she's like shows Redford giving her the present. Literally, like a minute into the movie, when she's talking about Redford, it cuts to like a shot of him against the rising sun in the safari, but it also cuts to them dancing. And that dance is when he's dancing with her at the end of the movie when her house is empty. So it's like weirdly peppered in foreshadowing that makes nothing until you get to the scene. Yeah.
Maybe the lion was Redford's spirit in there.
Maybe they match the hair matches.
I thought the ending just felt a little bit like they were checking off a to-do list because none of these characters were so isolated from each other in the film. You only saw them interacting with Karen that she then had to go through the process of like having her one-on-one moment with all of them. So there couldn't be this big culmination or this big conclusion. I didn't hate that. I don't know what else you would do to end the film.
It would have been so inappropriate if they made it into like a big set piece where like he's flying back and she's like waving at him. The plane hits a steeple and blows up.
Oh, yeah.
Side of a mountain.
I wasn't even thinking of his death or his crash because I think that worked. I mean, it's what happened, but I also think from a storytelling point of view, it doesn't change the. I don't think there's like a tonal shift there. No. I just think you get this sort of like prolonged goodbye. You know, when you have that coworker that gives like 6 weeks notice and then every meeting they're like, oh, I didn't see you. I'm leaving in 5 more weeks. Goodbye. You know, like kind of felt like that.
It's like saying you're going to leave Facebook like a month before you do it. You're like, in 3 weeks, I'm going to leave and I love you all. Like,
right. Eh. So and then but she had some nice moments with these people. It was just a little prolonged, but I thought like the lions were nice. I thought the funeral was nice. I just
yeah.
There was no emotion. There was no emotion. There was.
I thought there was plenty of emotion.
No, there was no emotion. There was no vulnerability. There was no vulnerability moments. The only vulnerability moments and emotions I felt were from the animals, the cows.
It was no Notebook. We know.
It would be
absolutely not.
Totally inappropriate, though, if jackals showed up at his grave instead of lions. They're like.
monkeys.
I wasn't expecting that. Like
monkeys throwing poo, you know. Anyway, all right.
Selling poop.
Let's take a quick break here. I'll do my little housekeeping, and we will get to our wrap up here. Before we get to that, I just want to thank everyone for tuning into our show. Your feedback would be greatly appreciated. So if you agree or disagree with our opinions on Out of Africa, let us know. Email us at backtotheframerate@gmail.com. You can also find us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and TikTok. Our handle is backtotheframerate. And on Twitter, which is backframerate. You can sign up for our monthly newsletter, Framerate Monthly. And to do that, just send us an email at backtotheframerate@gmail.com. Also, the best way of helping us grow is to just spread the word about our podcast. Tell your friends, family, your pets, your coworkers, I don't know, anybody you know, and tell them to check out our podcast and leave a rating and review. That's the most important thing. We love reviews. So thank you very much. All right, let's get to our MVP. Very important. We're going to begin with B. What is your MVP of Out of Africa?
It was that dinner scene with Barkley and Redford. It's so good.
Okay. I buy it. I guess I'm next. My MVP. Here we go. My MVP, Simon Trevor and Jack Colfer. Do you know who these people are? Mm-mm. Neither do I. All I know is that they are both the second unit directors for this film. And I have no idea how involved they were in the process of capturing those gorgeous vistas of the African landscape, but I'm crediting them. I think what they do is what elevates this film. They gave us those memorable sequences, all the beautiful shots of the African landscape of Kenya. I think I'm not going to not credit Sidney Pollack for his direction, but you know what he does with Robert Redford, I think, you know, I'll tell you all everything I think about him as a director for this film. But still, the second unit, first time and only time I might actually make the second unit team my MVP. They are fantastic. And that's what makes this movie. I think this actually is the reason why I think this movie is so memorable as well. I don't think it's the love story. It's the things like the flying sequences. It's all of these incredible, breathtaking shots. I think this is what people remember from this film. You know, it's how it's entered into the zeitgeist. Critics, audiences, I think in some, for the most part, just think, aren't remembering necessarily the romance, but really this, just the sweeping nature vibe of this movie. It has this like David Lean quality to it. It reminds us of Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai, all these movies that had this grand CinemaScope feel to them. I think that's the feeling that this movie gives you, not necessarily the romance of these two leading of these two leads. So
you hit the nail on that. That's why I love it. I mean, it's the grandiose epicness of it and the score. It's got that scope where you're just like, wow.
Yeah. And that's what it is. So that, like I said, you know, this film was gorgeous and I'll give credit where credit is due. But it's also, I wanted to say this earlier, they are making a movie in one of the most gorgeous locations on earth. So at the same time, I feel like any film that showed up to make a movie here to showcase this region would have probably received the Best Cinematography nomination. They could have accidentally hit the record button, dragged the camera behind the grip truck, and gotten amazing footage.
Also, having no CGI, so it's like when there's a train going through the open plains, it's a train. Like, it's really there, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Having spent several months in Kenya, hard agree. It's beautiful. It's so gorgeous out there. It's one of my favorite places on the planet Earth. It's It really is that stunning.
Yeah.
I just decided that, yeah, no, never mind. But yeah. I have to ask you about Kenya. Now I'm inspired. Yeah.
All right. Sam, what's your MVP?
It's kind of tied into the same thing, but I'm going to be very stereotypical and say the flying plane scene, because I just, mm-hmm. that with the score just exemplifies the feeling of this movie. I also thought that they did a really good job. Like, you can tell the shots of her and Redford are like matted in, but they're not that bad. They're not as glaring as the opening of the movie. And they cleverly have the pilot and the other, like the shot where it's in the plane looking out through it, where it's like clearly there's people just wearing their costumes. But that whole scene just exemplifies the tonality of the movie. I was almost going to say that dinner scene that B was talking about, because I love that scene. But just for the sake of it, the plane is just like, it's just epicness.
All right. Ellie, what's your MVP of this movie?
Yeah, you know, I think it's gonna be the one where they're actually, she's gonna go drop off the supplies, and that tribe walks by, like five people walking by at the end. Yeah, that's the MVP scene for me, because I don't know, I no idea what the point of that tribe walking by was for. So that's the MVP.
I thought you were gonna say the hippos.
No, that's just, the animals are just so ugly. The animals are just so ugly. They don't even deserve an MVP. But that scene just got me, man. That's just,
Well, you too. I don't know if you noticed that scene where that tribe, what was the name of that tribe, by the way?
The Maasai.
Maasai. So that scene where that Maasai is coming at Adam. Coming toward Streep and then passes off to right. Shot for shot, pretty much mirrors the scene early in the movie where she's at the standoff with the lioness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's supposed to be some connection to this threat that's out there, that's this imminent danger, but yet it goes off to her right, sort of like.
And yet, I did not find or feel the danger. So I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
That scene.
I'm not saying it was successful. I'm just saying that's what it was trying to do.
When she goes off on the journey and like the Maasai pass her, the way that scene opens, you talk about the second unit, like it's just a regular dialogue scene on her farm. No, she's talking to the general and literally says something like, "Where is my husband?" And then it just cuts out of nowhere to this huge, like wide vista shot, where you see her like team moving through the plains, and like John Barry's score swells out of nowhere. That always takes me by surprise, that cut. I'm always like, wow, here we go. Like it every single time I'm not expecting it.
You know what? I got a sense in this movie that Meryl Streep plays the wife that always wants her husband to be around. And she does the same thing to her lover, Redford. At some scene where he's like, why are you always leaving? The husband, why are you always leaving? And I'm like thinking like, can you just like, why is she so not independent? Like, why? I feel like she wants to, I feel like she wants to control that sort of, I don't know, like, the type of women that who has a husband and is always asking the husband, where you're going, why you're going, stay with me. I think it's because maybe I come from a different status where I don't really care if you go, I don't care. Just, you know, like even when I was married, I was like, I'm going to go out, like, whatever, I go. And, you know, to me the idea of having to keep a man in your house for you, I don't know. It doesn't, I don't, something there didn't grab me, so
okay,
let's get that's to- I think that's like an example that you were talking about earlier where the film's not great at showcasing the passage of time, because they weren't gone like for the evening, they were gone for like 6 months to a year. And I think she just wanted some like regular, you know, companionship.
It doesn't show it that well.
Maybe that's the difference
with voiceover. He's like, When will the rains come? Like Sabu, it's a lot, you know, many days go by before the rain, and he's gone for like months. If maybe that shot where, like you said, it was similar to like the lion approaches and the Maasai's approaches. I think like the connection there is that maybe she's getting stronger, or she's like, I see what you're saying there, but it's like the same feel to it.
I think it's supposed to mirror that and showing her development in her strength somehow. I don't know if it works. And also it's kind of problematic that they're comparing a tribe to animals also.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we need to let's wrap this up. Let's get to our decision if this movie is deserving to come into our vault or purged out into the asteroid apocalypse. We're going to begin with B.
Ooh. Let it go. I say no.
Okay. I'm also going to say no, and I'm sorry to yuck anyone's yum on this podcast, Sam. But I think there's other movies like this that do it better. So I also say no.
I don't stand a chance here, but I'm gonna say yes.
Okay. It's been noted, Ellie. I think we know what you're gonna say. Purge. Or you might surprise us.
Purge it.
Kill it.
Out.
All right.
In another.
Oof. Already gone. Never to be seen again.
Maybe in another planet. I don't know.
Let's give it another one. just to make sure. That was for the second reel. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Ellie.
It doesn't matter. It's fine.
All right. All right. Well, that is our show this week. Back to the Frame Rate is part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. We also wish to thank Brian Ellsworth for our show opening. On behalf of all of us, we bid you farewell from the fallout shelter. Your presence in our underground sanctuary is truly appreciated. We are truly sorry you cannot join us, but we want to express our gratitude for your company. If you are finding solace in our discussions, we kindly ask that you please subscribe and leave a rating and review. Your support is the beacon of light that brightens our confined space. Head on over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes, Spotify, whichever portal connects you to our broadcast, and share your thoughts. Until we emerge from the fallout, stay with us, keep hope alive, and keep those reviews coming. This is the end of our transmission. Back to the Frame Rate, signing off.
I want you to know it's over.
Well, bye.
Bye.